Brian Jennings has the news in full.
Israel says it will continue its military offensive in Gaza despite international condemnation after the shelling of a United Nations-run school where thousands of Palestinians were sheltering. At least 15 people were killed and dozens more injured as civilians lay sleeping. The UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon described what happened as unjustifiable and reprehensible. The Commissioner General of the UN Relief Agency UNRWA, Pierre Krachenbuhl, said he believed the evidence pointed to Israel being responsible.
What maybe the world forgets as we are sitting here in Gaza is that people of Gaza have nowhere to go. So when fighting starts and they move, it is not as if they can cross a border into somewhere. It's not as if they can find refuge. There is, in the meantime, no place that is safe. And if the last refuge that we thought would be offered to displaced people, which are our school buildings, the sanctity of which must be respected by all parties, and if it is not, it is intolerable, and the world has to know it.
Israeli government spokesman Mark Regev said Israel did not target civilians and would apologise if the attack was proved to have been caused by stray fire from its forces.
When it's shown that we've mistakenly killed civilians, we've apologised. When there was that terrible story of the four boys on the beach, President Peres himself got up and said, we apologise as a country. We don't want to hurt innocent Gaza civilians. That's not our desire. We have a policy. We don't target civilians.
Israel has announced that it's mobilised 16,000 additional reservists, taking their total to 86,000 as its military offensive in Gaza continues. Public radio in Israel quoted a senior military officer as saying that the destruction of militants' remaining tunnels into Israel could be complete in a few days. Gardaí and Navan have begun a murder investigation following the discovery of a man's body in a field in County Meath. The man, who was in his 20s and was known to them, was shot dead. He was reported missing by his family earlier in the week. Our crime correspondent, Paul Reynolds.
The scene of the latest gun murder at Ballymacan in County Meath remains sealed off for a forensic examination today. The body of a Dublin man in his 20s was found in a field there by a farmer at around 5 o'clock yesterday evening. He had been shot a number of times. His body was removed last night to Our Lady of Lourdes Hospital for a post-mortem. Originally from Donaghmead in Dublin, he had been reported missing to Drogheda Gardaí by his family 3 days ago. It's believed he went with another man to meet a group of men to collect money when he was killed. He was known to the Gardaí for his involvement in serious crime and was suspected of being involved in the murder of the real IRA leader Alan Ryan in September of 2012. Gardaí and Navan have now begun a murder inquiry and have appealed for anyone with information to contact them.
Argentina has defaulted on its debt for the second time in 13 years. It's been unable to resolve its differences with US hedge funds that hold $1.3 billion worth of bonds bought at a discount after the country last defaulted in 2001. They wanted full repayment of the debt and were backed by a US federal court. Other creditors had agreed to a write-down. Speaking in New York, the country's economy minister, Axel Kicillof, said Argentina could not legally meet the demands of what he called the vulture funds.
What was the offer that the Argentine government presented? It was to accept the same terms as the creditors in 2005 and 2010. With this, they would be getting 300% profit. This offer would be legal for Argentina and would not break any contracts that we have signed. But it was not accepted by the vulture funds because obviously they want more.
Two former directors of Anglo-Irish Bank are due to be sentenced today for giving illegal loans to developers to buy shares in the bank. 52-year-old Patrick Whelan, Anglo's former director of lending in Ireland, and 63-year-old William McAteer, the bank's former finance director, were convicted in April of giving the loans to 10 customers of the bank 6 years ago. Judge Martin Nolan adjourned sentencing to assess the men's suitability for community service after strongly criticising the role of the former financial regulator in the matter. Our legal affairs correspondent, Orla O'Donnell.
Patrick Whelan and William McAteer were convicted of giving illegal loans to the so-called Maple 10 developers to buy shares in Anglo in July 2008. It was the first criminal prosecution of this offence in this country. The loans were part of a scheme to deal with the huge interest Sean Quinn had built up in Anglo through gambling on its share price. Following the lengthy trial, Judge Martin Nolan said Mr. Whelan and Mr. McAteer had had a duty to stop the illegal scheme. But he criticised the attitude and behaviour of the financial regulator. He said it would be most unjust to jail the two men when it seemed to him a state agency had led them into error and illegality. He adjourned the case until today to assess their suitability for community service.
President Michael D. Higgins and the Duke of Kent are to unveil a cross of sacrifice to honour Ireland's war dead at Glasnevin Cemetery in Dublin at lunchtime today. The Duke is president of the Commonwealth War Graves Commission. The event coincides with the centenary of the outbreak of World War I. Live coverage of the event will be broadcast in a special programme on RT1 Television and RT News Now from 1:20 this afternoon. There was no winner of the midweek lottery jackpot of just under €4.9 million. The numbers drawn were 7, 8, 13, 18, 24 and 41. The bonus number was 23. Now the time is coming up to 8:07. The weather forecast, it will be cloudy at first today with some scattered outbreaks of rain. Showery rain will be occasionally heavy this afternoon with a risk of thunder. Drier and brighter weather in the west later, extending to all parts. Highest temperatures 18 to 22 degrees.
Yesterday evening, close to the Louth Meath border, a man's body was found in a field. The state pathologist visited the scene last night. Let's get the latest now from our crime correspondent, Paul Reynolds. Paul, what do we know or what happened?
Well, at this stage, we know the victim is 26 years of age. His name is Paul Gallagher. He was from Newbrook Road in Donaghmead in Dublin. He went with another man to meet a number of men in County Meath on Monday night. He got out of a car on his own. He met with a number of people and was shot dead. Now, it appears at this stage that the other man who was with him fled the scene and didn't alert the Gardaí on Monday night. His family, Mr. Gallagher's family, became concerned and they made a number of inquiries among his friends and associates, and they were satisfied he was missing, and they reported the fact that he was missing to Gardaí in Drogheda. Yesterday evening at around 5 o'clock in the afternoon, a farmer was out in a field in Ballymacken near Collin in County Meath, and he came across Mr. Gallagher's body on the ground. He had been shot dead. It's the ninth gangland murder so far this year.
It's a familiar phrase, but it is fair to say he would be known to Gardaí.
Yeah, he had previous convictions. He was in court several times. He'd been the subject of bench warrants for not turning up for court and had been arrested by the Gardaí for a number of times for his involvement in serious and organised crime. He was linked to a major North Dublin criminal gang which was involved in organised and serious crime, including drug dealing. Now, that gang had been feuding with the real IRA over recent years. The gang had refused to pay protection money. It had targeted the real IRA leader, Alan Ryan, and he was shot dead 2 years ago. The victim, Mr. Gallagher, was suspected of some involvement in that he may have sourced the car, but that isn't definite. He was also known to be involved in drugs dealing with that criminal gang. There was some suggestion last night that he owed money for drugs and that he may have thought that he was going to that meeting on Monday night in County Meath to collect money when he himself was shot dead. He's also suspected of being involved in a shooting last April where a man was shot and seriously injured at his home in County Meath.
Would it be fair to say Mr. Gallagher would have known that his life was in danger?
Yeah, there is some suggestion. There was some suggestion that he may have been aware of that last night. I mean, obviously there are a number of lines of inquiry and the Gardaí are going to keep an open mind because of his involvement in criminal activity. It's more likely that this was linked to criminal gangs rather than dissident Republicans, even though there is some suggestion that he was linked to the Alan Ryan murder. It's more likely to be connected to the activities of criminal gangs, and Gardaí do believe this murder is drugs related. There are some reports that he had become more erratic and unstable in recent times, and that he may have been aware his life was in danger, but he does appear to have been set up, lured to his death. I mean, he went to this area, and it's quite a remote area on one pretext, and appears to have been ambushed and shot dead.
All right, Paul Reynolds, thank you for that.
All schools in the West African country of Liberia have been shut down and non-essential government workers sent home for 20 days as authorities attempt to halt the spread of the deadly Ebola virus. The UN says close to 700 people have died from the virus in West Africa since this outbreak began. So with countries on high alert to prevent the spread of the deadly disease, what's being done here to protect public health? We're joined on the line now by Dr. Dorina O'Flanagan, who's Director of the
the Health Protection Surveillance Centre with the HSE. Dr. O'Flanagan, thank you for joining us. What steps, if any, has Ireland taken to deal with this outbreak and the potential of it reaching our shores?
Good morning, Claire. It's important to say, while Ebola virus is indeed one of the most dangerous and virulent viruses with up to 90% fatality rate, it's not highly infectious. It doesn't spread through the air like measles, and unlike flu, people are not infectious until they have symptoms. So therefore, it doesn't cause pandemics. And the people who are at most risk from this virus are the people who are living in the communities in Guinea, Sierra Leone, and Liberia. So, however, because it is such a serious disease, there are plans in place in Ireland should such a case present in Ireland. And, you know, these plans have been in place for a long time. The original guidance for the management of viral hemorrhagic disease was published in 2002, and it was more recently updated in 2012 when the National Isolation Unit in the matter, as the designated centre for managing cases of viral hemorrhagic diseases and other highly infectious viruses, was set up. So protocols and guidance documents have been prepared, and they have been sent through the system to general practitioners, to emergency departments, to infectious disease consultants, microbiologists, and the ambulance service.
Because in England, the Public Health England has briefed border officials and airport staff on the symptoms. Are we doing anything like that here?
Yeah, we have. We have our we have a Port Health Committee, and the Port Health Committee has been in touch with colleagues in ports, and the Port Health Environmental Health Officers have also information on the signs and symptoms of viral hemorrhagic disease, and indeed other viruses. You know, Ebola virus isn't the only virus that we have been monitoring. There's also the Middle East respiratory syndrome virus, MERS-CoV, and also, you know, the avian flu, H7N9 in China. So we have been sending out advice on all these emerging viral threats.
Because the world is so interconnected now, I mean, I know you said at the beginning that it's the communities immediately affected by this outbreak that really need to worry here. But are we not facing potentially a major threat because people are so mobile now?
Yeah, that's true. It is always possible, you know, that somebody who has visited the affected country could return. But it's much more likely if somebody comes back with symptoms from these affected countries that they have an illness such as malaria or typhoid, or even, you know, the common infections that infect us all, like pneumonia or urinary tract infection. So, you know, the guidance would indicate what the physicians should do in assessing a patient and see if they really are at risk.
And what should people be looking out for, Dorina, if they have returned from one of these areas, or if they suspect or they're worried that they might have contracted this virus?
Okay, so the thing is, if within 21 days they returned from one of these affected areas and they have a fever, well, then it's important to go to their general practitioner for assessment. And if necessary, their family doctor then will refer them and ring through to you know, the emergency departments and hospitals, asking what's the best way to send this patient in for assessment. And then the patient will be assessed to see whether or not they have had true contact, you know, with people who have been suffering from Ebola in these affected countries, you know, whether or not they've been in contact with dead bodies, whether or not they've had exposure to eating, you know, wild animals, bush meat. These are the major risks that occur, or indeed whether they, you know, were a healthcare worker looking after some of these patients. But the symptoms of the disease would be initially, in the initial stages, will be fever, weakness, muscle pain, headache, sore throat. Then they go on to get sicker and have vomiting, diarrhea. And finally, then they get rash and bleeding from, you know, into internal organs and also from external orifices like mouth, eyes. You know, they can get bloody diarrhea. So those would be, you know, the symptoms at the later stage. But as I said, people returning from these areas are much more likely to have the common illnesses such as malaria, typhoid, etc.
Okay. Dr. Doreen O'Flanagan, Director of the Health Protection Surveillance Centre, thank you for joining us and apologies for the quality of the phone line.
Back to Gaza, where fighting between Israeli soldiers and Hamas and other militant factions is continuing, the strip being pounded from the air, land and sea by the Israeli army. In return, rockets are being fired on a regular basis into Israel, most intercepted by the Iron Dome defence system, which shoots down rockets before they land. The death tolls on each side tells the real story. More than 1,300 Palestinians dead, mostly civilians. On the Israeli side, 56 soldiers dead, 3 civilians killed. Let's discuss the military tactics and strategies being used by both sides now with Tom Clonan, who's security consultant with the Irish Times. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning.
Would it be fair to say that Israel will not have expected to lose 56 soldiers?
Yes, if we cast our minds back to 2008, 2009, when the Israelis went into Gaza in a similar fashion in Operation Cast Lead, they killed 1,417, that's a conservative estimate, men, women and children in that ill-starred operation. And the purpose of Cast Lead back in 08, 09 was to stop missiles being fired into Israel and to destroy cross-border tunnels. And it failed in both of those objectives. The only outcome really in that operation was the destruction of lots of infrastructure in Gaza and the killing, as I said, of hundreds, over 1,000 innocent civilians, including over 300 children. So when you look at the raison d'etre for the current military campaign, which is almost a facsimile of that, it begs the question, what are Israel's war aims in this ground offensive in Gaza? Because the previous campaign, which was exactly the same, the Israelis have used there is no innovation in this campaign. It is precisely the same as the 2008-2009 campaign. But what's interesting here, as you pointed out, in 2008-2009, the Israelis lost 10 soldiers killed in action. And 3 of those, I believe, were killed in a road traffic accident. On this occasion, Hamas have killed 56 Israeli soldiers, and that is an own goal for the Israelis. I don't mean to sound cynical or to sound dismissive, but Hezbollah and other Islamic resistance groups, particularly radicalized elements on the Syrian border, will be watching that very closely, because it demythologizes the myth of Israeli military superiority.
The Israelis say their aim is to go in, take out these launch sites for rockets, and take out this tunnel network. Are they doing much more than that?
Well, they're committing war crimes. That's what they're doing. They're failing in their their objectives. But quite explicitly, under Protocol 1, Article 51, Sections 4 and 5A of the Geneva Convention, it says quite explicitly that you must not use weapon systems or, and I quote, a method of attack which cannot be directed at or limited to a specific military objective. And here's the critical point. Or where there is a concentration of civilians or civilian objects. The Geneva Conventions explicitly prohibit any attack which can cause, and again I quote, incidental loss of life or damage to civilians or civilian objects. And in that case, the attack must be called off. And it's quite clear that the Israelis military are using the full spectrum of their weapon systems. They're using the Air Force, naval assets off the coast and ground troops in a heavily populated environment. Can I just emphasize, 48% of the population of Gaza are children. And if you use the weapon systems that the Israelis are using there, civilian deaths are an inevitable consequence.
You're an expert in this field. You know that the Israeli army can take out an apartment in an apartment block if they need. We've all seen the evidence of it. And Paul Mason referred to it earlier. Take the top floor off a building and leave the rest of the building intact. So can... I mean, what you're saying clearly, in your view, they're committing war crimes, and you're saying they're using the full range of weaponry. Is it the reality that the Israeli army is setting out to do a lot more than what it's stated publicly?
Well, if the objective is to, as they say, to destroy tunnels and prevent the firing of missiles, their operation in 2008-2009 failed to do that. They're not doing anything different now. They're committing war crimes. They're terrorising the population. I can only come to the conclusion that this is a collective punishment on the people of Gaza to terrorise them. And just to be very, very clear on this, Article 17 and 15 of the Geneva Convention says that if you take it upon yourself to invade a civilian area, like a city, you must provide what's known as a neutralised zone. In other words, you must provide an evacuation corridor into a neutralised zone, and I quote, for the removal from the besieged or encircled areas of wounded, sick, infirm, elderly, children and pregnant women.
And we know that can't happen in Gaza because the people have nowhere to go, and in the cases where they go where they're told to go, beaches and UN shelters, we've seen what's happened in the past, they've been attacked there. But the point people would make is that Hamas is also committing war crimes, is it not?
Absolutely, and this is something that is Hamas, by firing Qassam, Grad and Farj missiles into Israel, they're committing, this is a premeditated, systematic committal of war crimes. Not only are they firing missiles at civilian targets within Israel, but they're also jerry-rigging weapons. For example, putting 120mm pipes and fins made of rusty material on Qassam rockets. And this is something that has been pointed out by international agencies before. So I think in this case, both sides in this conflict, both Hamas and the Israeli military, are committing war crimes. And my sympathies go for the ordinary people on both sides.
Tom, is it not time that somebody went in to look at this? We've heard there's a review underway at what happened on the beach. We were told last night that the IDF are going to review what happened in the shelter in Jabalia. Is it not time that somebody external went in and examined exactly what's happening?
Well, first of all, this offensive must stop immediately because it is a war crime. I mean, the shooting of children in cold blood, and we have the case of Iman Al-Hans, who was shot by an Israeli army officer. This is a 13-year-old girl who approached an Israeli position carrying a school bag. The radio traffic says she's a 10-year-old girl, over, she's scared to death, over. This officer walked up to this 13-year-old girl and shot her twice in the head and then shot her a further 8 to 10 times.
And the correspondence that was revealed at the time, or the conversation between the soldiers at that checkpoint, revealed quite a lot about the tactics deployed by the IDF.
Well, it's my own experience. You know, when I go back to my own service in Lebanon with the butchering of innocent Lebanese civilians in our neighbouring UN position in Qana, the Israelis do deliberately target UN positions and places of safety. Your earlier contributor from Channel 4 spoke about the eyewitness accounts of an attack on a school.
They insist they don't and say this could be a mistake, yeah. Slightly got it wrong.
Again, a recruit in any training programme in the army would recognise that the Israelis are using indirect fire weapon systems like artillery, 155 artillery, 120mm mortars, to respond to attacks from the vicinity of schools, which is inevitable given the built-up nature of the area. But they have a duty to manoeuvre into those situations and, if necessary, to use direct fire weapons and protect civilians, minimise losses. Could I also say, in relation to Hamas, Hamas are also in breach of the Geneva Conventions, Article 51.7, in that they are using the civilian population as human shields. So this is giving the Israelis, I suppose, some cover, but the disproportionate and indiscriminate use of force by the Israelis is a war crime. It's not my opinion. It's not a subjective view on my part. It is a fact, and it brings Israel into disrepute. And Israel is a great country. They're wonderful people, but they're sowing the seeds of their own destruction by the events in Gaza, and it is radicalising young Muslims all over the world, and it gives oxygen to these crazy groups like ISIS and Al-Qaeda.
I just want to ask you quickly,
they have to stop.
Quickly, in conclusion, Tom, about the news that emerged last night that the United States has confirmed that it has restocked Israelis' ammunition. It has effectively given Israel supplies of ammunition to strengthen what they're doing. It appears the Israelis have run out.
Well, it's a shameful decision to resupply or to give ammunition in a campaign like this, which is so clearly in breach of international law and the laws of armed conflict. And again, it's something that brings the international community into disrepute. And I know that the head of UNRWA in the Palestinian Authority said that the international community should hang its head in shame. And, you know, really, forget about reviews or investigations. These hostilities must stop. Like, even the Americans, when they invaded Fallujah in 2004, the Americans only had 26,000 troops, and they came under a lot of criticism for their invasion of Fallujah. But they evacuated 200,000 civilians from Fallujah before they attacked. The Israelis have concentrated these people in this ghetto. Gaza is effectively a concentration camp.
All right, Tom Clonan, security consultant. Thanks for coming in to us this morning. We've already heard that on the programme from the HSE about its preparedness for a case of the Ebola virus here. And we've heard that Liberia is to shut down schools and markets and place all non-essential public servants on leave in a bid to curb the spread of the virus. The epidemic has been spreading across West African nations for several months now, killing over 670 people. Guinea is one of the worst affected areas. Tarek Yasarevic is a spokesperson for the World Health Organization and is there. Good morning to you, Tarek. And if I could firstly ask you about these measures which are being...
Good morning and thank you for having me in your contact.
Not at all. These measures that are being put in place in Liberia, is it the only way to try and curb the spread of this virus?
Well, what we are dealing here with is an Ebola outbreak that is spread over different geographical areas of three countries where we have different localities where transmission chain is taking place. We need what needs to be done, and that's basically to put in place a set of measures that would allow us to find every sick person and every infected person and try to trace down all those who have been in close contact with this person, and also to vary in a manner those who died from Ebola. So experience shows really the best way to deal with the Ebola outbreak is really to go after those who have been finding them, treating them in adequate conditions, and training health workers on how to use protective equipment, informing patients as well, having enough of lab capacity. So there's a set of measures that have to be done. This is what we are doing in all three countries, and we are really trying to support as much as we can ministries of health of Sierra Leone, Liberia, and Guinea to cope with this epidemic.
A slight delay in the line and some breakup as well, so apologies to listeners for that. But Tarek, how achievable is that, given the fact that we're seeing the virus spread across quite vast countries, often sparsely populated, with pretty poor healthcare and pretty poor infrastructure? How achievable is doing all of what you say?
Well, it is achievable. We have seen here where the response started when outbreak is being declared end of March. So we have seen that we were able to stop the transmission in different towns of the country. So there is no magical cure there. We need to have all these measures in place. We need to have treatment centers so people can be treated in a safe way. They don't present danger for their family. We need to have a surveillance system in the community trying to alert health authorities about suspect cases, deaths. We need to have lab capacity. So we need to do all of this. It takes time. It takes a lot of resources because you have to multiply these actions by number of locations where transmission is ongoing. And the only way is really that everyone gets mobilized and try to contribute to it.
What about Guinea, where you are at the moment? The social response and the, I suppose, the response to rumour and people's claims over where the virus could come from, some pretty disturbing developments in Guinea.
Well, what we have seen here is basically population being faced with Ebola for the first time. And what happened in this is very remote area, bordering three countries like Liberia, Guinea, Sierra Leone, where majority occurs. This is a very remote area, small villages. What they speak to one day is just foreign medical teams or low class coming to their village in protective equipment. But people were anxious. They had questions to ask, and sometimes intervention teams maybe did not have a time to explain properly. And that's why what we had here in this part of Guinea was villages that were refusing to allow medical teams to come in. And the other thing that contributed to that is all messages that were going to the population were saying there is no cure and vaccine against Ebola. So people were thinking, then why would I go and die somewhere else when I can stay with my family? And media has contributed to that as well. So what we are really trying to focus now is take time, explain to population what it is, go through community leaders, have a strong engagement from the national authorities, but also focus on messages that are more positive, saying that those who go to treatment center earlier have better chances of survival.
All right. Tarek, thank you for taking our call this morning. And again, apologies to listeners for the quality of that telephone line there. That's Tarek Yasarevic of the World Health Organization in Guinea.
Des is back with more sports news. Hi again, Des.
Morning to you, Claire. We're starting with last night's European football. Celtic facing the prospect now of missing out on qualifying for the financially lucrative Champions League group stages after a heavy defeat in Poland. Despite Callum McGregor giving Celtic an early lead, they lost 4-1 to Legia Warsaw, and in truth, it could easily have been much more. The Polish side missed two penalties. Celtic played the entire second half with 10 men after Effie Ambrose was sent off just before their break. Their new manager, Ronnie Delia, didn't hide his frustration afterwards.
I need to be much clearer to what I expect and how we're going to perform as a team, defensively and offensively. And today it was we just lose our heads, and that's not good enough. So we have to start working, learn from this very quick, because we need to have a whole different attitude and discipline in our play.
In other Champions League qualifiers, Zenit St. Petersburg slumped to a 1-0 defeat in Cyprus against Limassol, and Azerbaijan's Qarabag pulled off an even bigger upset. They beat Salzburg 2-1 despite finishing with only 9 men. Everton have signed striker Romelu Lukaku from Chelsea in a club record £28 million sterling deal. The Belgium international has agreed a 5-year deal. In the big overnight friendly game in New York, Liverpool beat Manchester City on penalties after a 2-2 draw. Stefan Jovetic twice put City in the lead. Liverpool hit back through Jordan Henderson and Raheem Sterling. On to Gaelic games, and Clare's under 21 hurlers had a magnificent win in the Munster under 21 hurling championship last night, their third in a row. Cork were the opponents, and Clare easily beat them by 128 to 113. A superb performance from the Clare team. They dominated throughout. They led at half time by 115 to 5 points. Afterwards, Captain Tony Kelly paid special tribute to joint managers Donal Maloney and Gerry O'Connor, who since 2010 have led this group to two successive minor titles, followed by three successive under 21 titles. Brian Carthy heard why from Donal Maloney.
We're very fortunate that we've had a group of players, or with three different groups of players now, that have they've had, you know, great capacity and capability from a hurling skill perspective. So that's a tribute to the development squads and the work that has been done coming up along. It's also a tribute to their clubs. I mean, you know, clubs have done some tremendous work to produce some of these players. But the second most important factor is that they've had the desire, because yeah, they've had massive desire, and a lot of these guys, you know, I've been part of the senior panel as well, and with Davey and Joe Connor and Mike Deegan and Louis Mulqueen, they've worked very, very hard with them, right? So they've a very, very high level of fitness, and you can see that, right? So a lot of people working very hard, pulling in the one direction, and long may that continue.
Now, day three of the Galway Festival produced a first ever win in the Galway Plate for trainer Noel Mead, and the biggest career victory to date for young jockey Shane Shortall. He rode 14-1 chance, rode to riches to victory in the feature, making it a double for the young jockey because he had already won earlier on greatness. The feature today is the Galway Hurdle, and Pádraig Lodge has been talking to one of the leading jockeys in the race, David Casey.
All right, Salon Chief was a decent horse. He's won a couple of races earlier on in the season. Punchestown and Fairyhouse and that, and second last time out he's in good order, so should handle the ground well enough. And you know, I think the track won't be a problem either. He's won in Cork and places like that, he's won on creek tracks, and he has the stamina because he's won over 2.5 as well, so I'm hopeful of a good ride.
What sort of track is Galway to ride, and has it been a good place for you through the years?
Yeah, when the ground is like it is this time, when it's good ground, it can be tough track to ride. It's very tight, you're always on the turn, so you need a lot of luck in running, and it can be difficult to try and get a run, you know. But that's part of the game. It's easier when it's softer ground; they're a bit more spread out, you know. But it's quick this week, so it'll be tough. It'll be hard going.
Yeah, big race ahead now. Across channel, the Goodwood Festival continues. Michael Owen's Brown Panther seeking another win in the Goodwood Cup. Elsewhere, Northern Ireland's Hall of Boxing medals at the Commonwealth Games in Glasgow reached a record 9 after 6 more wins yesterday. And finally, for now, in golf, the big summer tournaments continue today. The WGC Firestone International gets underway in Ohio.
Des, thank you for that.
Well, today marks the official anniversary of the start of World War I. Nearly 10 million men died in the war to end all wars between 1914 and 1918. 210,000 Irish servicemen served in the First World War, and up to 50,000 of them were killed. Dr. Heather Jones is Associate Professor at the London School of Economics, and she joins us from there. And John Horn is Professor of Modern History and Director for the Centre of War Studies in Trinity College Dublin, and he's here in studio with us in Dublin. Professor Horn, I would start with you because we're focusing on the outbreak of war, the first months of conflict and so on. Why is today considered the anniversary of the beginning of World War One?
Well, good morning, Claire. I'm not sure today is in some regards. It was a rolling start, which went really over a week. And it depends how you define the beginning, because there is the order for mobilisation, and then there's the declaration of war. But basically, on Tuesday the 28th to Wednesday the 29th of July 1914, the Austrian army sent gunboats up the Danube River, having declared war on Serbia and bombarded Belgrade. So that night of the 28th to the 29th are the first shots of the Great War. And then successively, different countries of the major powers come in. So today was the day when the Russians, a big player, declared war on Germany. And Saturday, the Germans declare war. Oh, sorry, the Russians mobilize. And Saturday, the Germans declare war on Russia. By the following Monday, the Germans have declared war on France and have issued an ultimatum to neutral Belgium, saying, we want to cross your territory. And that's when the British say, well, here's an ultimatum. Either you withdraw from Belgium or we go to war. And that ultimatum expires on the 4th of August. So you can say that the big powers come in over a week. It's a rolling start. But we always have to remember that then there's a second round of other powers, Turkey, Italy, Bulgaria, which come in late 1914 and 1915, and even a kind of third round when the United States comes in 1917.
Okay, well, Dr. Heather Jones, we'll get your view on when the actual start date should be marked. Do you agree with Professor Horn's assessment there?
I would indeed. And I think from my point of view, July the 28th is really when hot war begins, breaks out. The assassination itself, 28th of June, is the point when diplomatic crisis starts, but it's really when those shells hit Belgrade that we see war as such starting. Now, the question as to whether that was going to be a localised Balkan conflict between Austria-Hungary and Serbia or whether it would become a European war then unfolds in the next few days.
And how prepared at this stage are the great powers for a war like this?
Well, in many ways, there's a variation between the great powers, and it's important to emphasise that some powers were better prepared than others. So powers with conscript armies, for example, Germany and France, are very good at mobilising their troops. They're very good at having men on the ground quite quickly. However, their war plans actually leave a lot to be desired. So powers vary in how much they're able to mobilise, how quickly they're able to mobilise men, but also in how good their war plans are. And actually the British are in many ways quite unprepared for a continental war. They've mainly depended on their navy. They have an army that's really designed for small colonial conflicts, and they're really not prepared for a major continental war when war breaks out for them on the 4th of August.
And of course, Professor Horn, nobody could have expected that this war was going to last as long as it did. I mean, if you're sitting looking at this in 1914 on this particular day, you could never have predicted what was about to unfold.
That's right. People imagined that it would be a short war. Some few people, there had been a few visionaries, seers almost, the pacifist Russian Ivan Bloch, who wrote a book at the end of the 19th century saying, if there's a European war, this is going to be a catastrophic war. There'll be the empty battlefield. People will be killed by long-distance shells. Whole societies will be worn out. It'll end in revolution.
Because things had changed. Technologies had moved on.
That's right. But the interesting thing about Bloch's conclusion is, he says, because he was really an optimist as a pacifist, he says, so because it would be suicide, it won't happen. And of course, we know it did happen. And that really is the key to it in many respects. If you ask, did people know, did the politicians, did the generals, the military, they're professionals after all, did they know what kind of war this would be? I think the answer is they did and they didn't. They saw, but they didn't see. So there had been prior wars, the South African War, the Russo-Japanese War in 1904-1905, a big conflict, two wars in the Balkans in 1912-1913. People had seen what high explosive shells could do. The soldiers had dug trenches to protect themselves. All this had been seen, and you could draw Bloch's conclusion from this and say, this is going to be a long war, this is going to be a stalemate war. But that wasn't the conclusion that they drew, because everybody said, well, we can't afford that kind of war. So it will be a short war. It'll be a bloody war, but it'll be over fairly soon with a clear victory one way or the other. Mm-hmm. So in that sense, nobody was prepared. And I would just add, I mean, I agree entirely with what Heather said, but there's one other aspect, I think, of the preparations. The kind of war people are prepared for was one in which, because they called up reservists, it wasn't just that you called up the conscript army, but you called up everybody who'd done conscription up to the age of about 50. So this means you're delivering armies of millions of men to the field. But nobody had envisaged the ammunition that would be necessary for a long war. They were all running out of shells by the autumn, and which then meant the war had to be an industrial war. And that, I think, is the clearest proof that nobody had anticipated the industrialized slaughter that this would turn out to be.
Heather, to come to you on a very big question, the perspective now, 100 years on, is there a consensus as to who was to blame for the outbreak of World War One?
Actually, there isn't a consensus among historians. There is some division as to how the war broke out. And there are two points of view, really, and I'm generalising here. Some historians argue that it was the Central Powers, so effectively Austria-Hungary in cahoots with Germany. Austria-Hungary wants to really knock out Serbia. There's a Serbian minority in the Austro-Hungarian Empire that's been quite difficult to manage and that is in many ways nationalist. And there's a sense that Austro-Hungarians feel threatened by the growth of Serbia as a state on its borders and that Germany supports them in that action. The other view is that, in fact, many states were responsible and responsibility was shared and that, in fact, we cannot attribute the main part of responsibility to the Central Powers, that, in fact, it's spread out, and particularly Russian mobilisation, which antagonises Germany by making Germany fear that Russia is going to invade, that Russia is mobilising on its borders, that plays a key role. So historians are divided, and in many ways there's been quite a recent debate around Christopher Clark's book, The Sleepwalkers, about this idea that, in fact, responsibility is shared. Other historians such as Annika Mombauer would argue that actually it's really the Central Powers who bear the main responsibility. And I would support the argument that Austria-Hungary is plays a major role and has a large share of the responsibility.
But right up to this point, the eve of war, could it have been averted at this late stage?
Yes, it could have. That the reality is that there are offers by Britain to call a conference, to organise a mediation process, and in fact Europe has very successfully kept the peace up to 1914. That's one of the reasons why there's been such economic progress. Western Europe in particular has seen an enormous internationalisation. It has seen a process of globalisation. You don't need a passport to move across borders at this point. And the way this has been preserved is through the conference system, through bringing states together to negotiate in conferences when there are international relations crises. And the great powers have a kind of idea of a balance of power and a concert of Europe. This collapses in 1914. And one of the reasons is that certain states do not want to take the mediation option.
Okay, John Horne, can we come back now to what was happening in Ireland? Because we were in the midst of home rule. That's where the focus was for both Britain and Ireland. Did all of that get parked when the outbreak of war happened?
It did in some respects. Within about 6 weeks, the sense of this far greater crisis in Europe and the existence of Britain and Ireland, the United Kingdom and the Empire somehow being in play. And I would just add to Heather's reply that in addition, I think there was this existential sense about 1914, different countries, different states somehow felt that unless they held up their end, then unless they met the challenge, they were threatened in their very existence. And that helps explain a great deal about the mood in 1914. So back to your question about Ireland, people in Ireland felt involved in the war. That's absolutely clear. And the Home Rule crisis was parked in this sense, that within 6 weeks, by the middle of September, a compromise had been pushed through by the government in which it was enacted but suspended for the duration of the war, and provision was made for some form, ill-specified, of opt-out by Ulster, by the Unionists in the North. And that allowed both sides, that's to say Unionists and Nationalists, to become involved in the war. The paradox is that in other countries, the outbreak of war led to a kind of suspension of politics. In the Irish case, it led to a suspension of what was going to be a civil war, and in a curious way allowed the politics back in. So while Home Rule was suspended, there was kind of jockeying on either side. So Sir Edward Carson and the Unionists very quickly got the agreement of the War Office that the Ulster Volunteers could form a division, the 36th Ulster Division. When John Redmond suggested the same thing for Irish nationalists. The government was really not, he envisaged an Irish brigade, was really not ready for that to happen, because at the same time there was a sense of perhaps their potential disloyalty. But nonetheless, 35,000 of the Irish volunteers joined up in what was to become the 16th Irish Division. So in that sense, yes, I would say the Home Rule crisis was left in suspension, but the politics continued.
Okay, Heather Jones, do you think that we were invested in it from a political point of view, or did those people enlist through economic necessity?
I think you have to differentiate between the different Irishmen in the British Army in the First World War. You have men who've enlisted before 1914 who've often joined up for economic reasons. The Irish urban poor, men who see the army as a way to earn money. Those who join up in 1914 are responding to Kitchener's call for volunteers. They're often middle class. They're often politically motivated, both by Home Rule or by Ulster Unionism, but also more generally by an idea of Europe, an idea of Belgium under threat, Catholic Belgium, that many Irish people feel an affinity with.
Okay, thank you very much indeed, Dr. Heather Jones, Associate Professor at the London School of Economics, and Professor John Horne from Trinity College Dublin. There will be an unveiling of the Cross of Sacrifice at Glasnevin Cemetery later on today at lunchtime, and there will be a special programme on RTE Television and RTE News Now at 1:20. More information on the outbreak of war on the RTE website, that's rte.ie/World War I.